Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Tiger and I'm joined today by Ian Wenig. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic as always.
How's the back?
Directionally better.
Directionally better. Moving in the right way. Okay. Well, not literally moving in the right way. That's the problem, but moving in the right direction. And we are joined by a younger and healthier Alec Rich, correct?
Correct. I'm pleased to report my back is fine and good to be with you again.
Good stuff. Just you wait, Alec. It will come. It will come. Fantastic. Well, look, thank you both for joining us. And thank you, listener, of course, for joining us for another episode. This week, we got some great stories to run down. And we're going to kick off with a scoop, which we published on Wednesday about Pershing implementing or soon to implement some new asset-based fees. So this is big news in the world of custodians and obviously all the RIAs who use them. Ian, this was your story. Before we get into the kind of where this places Pershing relative to its competitors and why it might be doing this, let's start at the beginning, as we always do, and ask for a rundown of the basic story.
Great. So this is a new scoop fresh off the marble slab, and that is that Pershing, one of the largest RIA custodians with $2.7 trillion in assets under custody administration, they're going to start charging some of its RIA clients a custody fee, which will be distributed in form of basis points based on their client's total assets under management.
Okay. So this is, for the most part, this is new. This wasn't something that, we'll come on to what most custodians do. Let's stick with just Pershing for the time being. For the most part, this wasn't something that it was doing before.
That's correct. So there were some firms that were already paying Pershing a custody fee. They figured out that was probably their most economical way of working them from a pricing perspective. But for some firms, yeah, this is new, and this was delivered to them in the form of amended custodial agreements very recently, with these changes that could take effect as soon as July 1st.
Okay. And so the basic thing here is that whatever the assets are that you custody with Pershing, so obviously just the ones on that particular platform, you'll now pay basis points on that. This probably isn't the most exciting thing to do in audio format, but can you quickly run down what we know of what those prices might be, basically?
Oh, my wife hates when I talk about basis points, but here we go. The highest fee will be 5 basis points for all assets between 0 and 499,999,999. Then it's going to step up gradually, 4.5 basis points from between 500 million to a billion. From 1 to 3 billion, it'll be charged 4.25 basis points. From 3 to about 5 billion, it'll be charged 4 basis points. And then it steps down significantly. So in that $5 to $10 billion range, it's 2 basis points. And anything over $10 billion is charged 1 basis point. So you can see that with this type of fee structure, Pershing's really moving to aggressively monetize its smallest customers, incentivizing them to grow, basically.
Okay. I guess my obvious question is, what were they doing before? So, you know, Pershing is not a nonprofit, so it had all these RIAs, wealth management firms, using it to custody assets. How was it monetizing them prior to that? And does this replace all that, or is this just a different way of effectively collecting the similar amounts of money from those firms?
Yeah. So I think the main way in which they have been monetizing before, and this is true for Charles Schwab and Fidelity as well, is that they will take the end client's uninvested cash. They'll put them in some sort of cash sweep account or some sort of cash product. They'll pay them a relatively low yield, maybe something in the range of 20 basis points on those cash assets. And then Pershing or Schwab or Fidelity will then take that cash and lend it out, and they will collect interest at a much higher rate. And so basically the difference, we call it the cash spread, that's very profitable for them.
Okay. So and obviously that's not changing to the best of our knowledge. No. And then there's also other fees as well that they would have collected beyond the cash sweep.
They could collect fees for account opening. They could collect fees on certain types of mutual fund trades if they're outside their no transaction fee platform. There's plenty of stuff that they could charge for, but it's kind of on that usage basis, right? Like you're charging per trade. You're charging per account opening. It's not this preset amount of money coming out of your account every quarter. I think that has a big effect psychologically on some of these firms.
Got it. And to the best of our knowledge currently, those other charges aren't necessarily changing, but this charge will come in regardless.
Yeah, this is the main thing.
Okay. And obviously from a personal point of view, it's nice. It's sort of, it's sticky, it's recurring. And I suppose, look, you know, it is simple. It's easy to see and to understand rather than trying to figure out a bunch of ad hoc charges that you might get over the course of a year as an RAA. What's their justification for doing it? What's their rationale?
Yeah, so I think it's worth, so I'll get to what they exactly said in a minute, but I think it's worth noting that custody has historically been, like the brokerage business, very, very low profit margins. So it's almost like running a supermarket. Those run like 2-3% margins. So yeah, being a custodian, you're not running a charity. Like they have every right to go out and try and make money. It's just the way in which that money is being collected now, it's just going to look a little different. So here's what they officially said. So I'm going to quote verbatim.
We do a voice of someone. You don't have to, I'm joking.
I don't know whose voice I could use there. We are committed to providing our clients with the best solutions and services to support their long-term goals. As part of this, we conducted a review of how we do business with our clients, including reflecting on their feedback. We're making several changes to increase transparency and simplify how our clients work with us. We believe these changes will allow us to continue to grow with and support our clients. We evaluate each of our relationships individually, and we do not have a one-size-fits-all model. We have several different pricing models configured for our clients, including clients that already have asset-based pricing. We are doing some fundamental adjustments, emphasis mine, to simplify and streamline our pricing.
Got it. Okay, so some people might have had something already, and we don't know if this is more expensive or less expensive than that. Some people didn't have something, and this might be simpler than what they had before, effectively. All right, what does everybody else do? So Pershing, as I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of, you know, the number three player in the custodian. It's not really a war or a battle because everything kind of stays the same, right? Yeah. Schwab's in at one, Fidelity's in at two, Pershing's in at three, and then there's a bunch of others. He'll probably be annoyed that we have dismissed them as such. But anyway, yeah, what are the main rivals? Basically, what does Schwab and Fidelity do, and how does this compare?
Okay, so let's start with Fidelity. So Fidelity actually has had some form of custody fee in effect for some of its clients for more than a decade. So back in 2013, so this is back when I was in college, Fidelity was going to charge an annual $10,000 custody fee for RAAs below $15 million in assets. So it makes sense. You're charging a fee for a very small AUM-based firm to become profitable. They also, around 2020, so this is back when I was writing at CityWire, they began charging firms a similar custody fee, either on a per account or a firm level custodial basis. But RAAs would get out of the fee if they agreed to put cash in their clients' accounts, swept into Fidelity's money market funds, which Fidelity would obviously charge a management fee, or they would put it into Fidelity's cash product, Fcash, which we've written extensively about. Now, Schwab, which is the Max Verstappen in the F1 race that is the custodial business, they have a pledge which says, and I'm going to read it as close to verbatim as possible, trying to find it on their website, is they have no custody fee, but they have no intention of changing that. And so I think that no intention, you could argue that's a weasel world. And to quote Homer Simpson, weaseling out of things what separates us from the animals. Except the weasel.
Okay. So in short, Fidelity has some sort of fee. Schwab currently doesn't and says that it won't, but who knows? But Pershing has. So I suppose by doing this, is this something that could make Pershing more appealing to RAAs or less appealing? You know, effectively, it sits in that number three spot. Okay, that probably, those numbers aren't necessarily changing too dramatically, particularly just over one, you know, fee change, but how does this sort of change its standing? How might people react to this?
So I think some good context was I spoke to Mike Papadis, who he's the chief executive of an RAA consultancy called Fusion Financial Partners, which works with a lot of these breakaway advisors. And what he explained is that you can have advisors that are willing to pay a fee if they know they're getting something bundled with that. You're paying a fee for a service. I mean, that's what we talk about with how advisors charge the end client at the end of the day. So if Pershing can offer this as a fee for premium service, access to premium asset management products, or access to alternatives, or access to superior software, then yeah, you can justify that kind of custodial fee. The issue is that if your advisor is more skeptical, and this is Mike's words, they could be viewed as a growth tax. And that it makes sense. Like you're basically penalized for starting out small. And if you're a breakaway and you're trying to bring those assets in, you know, even the multi-billion dollar teams only start with a couple hundred million in assets for those first couple of months as they try to win their clients back.
You're paying a bit more. Yeah, I suppose the counter would be as you do grow, obviously you start getting relatively decent sized breaks on your assets as they go up. And I suppose also, look, as a smaller firm, yeah, that, you know, there might, you might not get on another platform perhaps, or indeed there might be fees there too. Fantastic. Well, look, a really interesting Ian, fantastic story. And obviously I think there'll be some follow-ups certainly from us in the next few days on this. So there might be a bit more to read and learn about these charges. So keep it on locked. I don't know. Keep your browser open on CityWire RAA. As discussed before, it's not even CityWireRAA.com, is it? CityWire.com/RIA. Brilliant. Well, look, from the important, but potentially sort of quite granular in detail, to the frankly salacious Alec Rich, you're here today because of a story all about an advisor, their ex-wife, and a lawsuit. So I don't really know how to try and summarize this before turning to you. So I'm just going to ask you to do the hard part and tell us the top line. What are we talking about here?
Sounds good. Yeah, I mean, it is quite the alleged tale. So essentially, it's to sum it up, try to sum it up as succinctly as I can. James Four was married to Lisa Four, who is a broker with Osaic, and they were married for about 27 years and divorced in 2017. James then remarried Paulette Four in 2018. So the suit alleges that essentially James Four needed to access his retirement account, which was roughly $1 million, from Osaic. He had kind of a medical issue late last year and, you know, desired to switch his retirement account from Osaic to Morgan Stanley. And the suit alleges then that Lisa went about, and Osaic went about freezing that account and blocking the transfer to Morgan Stanley, which kind of set off this real kind of ugly situation that ensued.
So we'll come on to the juice in a minute because there's plenty of it.
Yeah.
Including a reference to a film which is now at least 10 years old, which we've had a lot of fun with here in the office, but probably most of which won't make it onto a podcast. His former wife was his advisor. That's the sort of context here, isn't
correct
it? Yeah. So it's not as if she's an advisor. She was his financial advisor, or looked after the family's money in that role. And now in that role, he's saying she and or the firm have stopped him from accessing it, stopped him from moving it across to a different wealth management firm.
Right. He was looking for a neutral third party to kind of manage that account, given kind of these rising monthly medical expenses that he had.
Okay. So let's get into some of the details. So he had and I guess we should all say at the beginning of this, just to avoid you having to say it every sentence, this is all alleged. This is in a suit that he has filed. And we haven't had a response. There's not been a formal response to that from his ex-wife. This is all from James, and we've not heard on a legal basis from Lisa. Correct. Just getting it right, because there's lots of different names in this.
Right, but okay. I should also say, in full disclosure of transparency, doing our reporting due diligence, I reached out to Osaic. I also was able to reach Lisa directly by phone, and both Osaic and Lisa declined to provide comment. So just putting that out there for the record.
No, very important. We're very much about setting the record straight and being tight from a legal point of view. Okay, cool. So let's get into some of the allegations then. So run us through it.
Sure. So essentially it kind of begins with Lisa kind of entering the accounting practice, which is a physical office that James owned and solely runs essentially, and notes that Lisa began kind of threatening staff and claiming to be the boss now. And it's, as Alex was alluding to earlier, we've kind of made comparisons to the 2013 thriller Captain Phillips, in which
the character played by Tom Hanks is told in an iconic scene by a Somali pirate that said Somali pirate is the captain now.
Correct. Yeah. So Lisa essentially claimed to be the boss now, to staff is what the lawsuit says. And kind of in the subsequent months, the suit also notes that she, you know, returned to that office and started kind of unlawfully seizing mail, including utility bills and financial correspondences. Now, the suit also notes that Lisa went so far as to start kind of trying to remotely block James's access to his iPhone and iPads, and, you know, took a couple of other, you know, actions targeted kind of at Paulette, who is the new wife of newer wife of James, essentially by kind of making these what James alleges are fraudulent claims of elder abuse, which kind of prompted visits by social services representatives and uniformed police officers as well.
And there was last thing, because I don't want you to just sort of just run through this, but there was also a private investigator involved in some degree.
Yeah, the suit also alleges that Lisa kind of hired a private investigator to follow Paulette around in kind of a means of intimidation as well.
But we should, again, emphasize that this is just James's suit. We don't know that the suit will necessarily, we don't know what the outcome will be. You know, it could be tossed.
Correct.
It may have no...
Right. People sue each other in America all the time. So, you know, it could turn out to not be that, you know, as alleged, obviously. But yeah, again, you know, as noted, we did reach out for comment and did not hear, Ozaic and Lisa declined.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we should keep our eye out for a formal response from them at some point. It raises an interesting question, I suppose, even if we, you know, except in theory that there might be absolutely nothing to this case. Just it raises an interesting question outside of the specifics of this about who you pick to be your financial advisor, I suppose. It reminds me of another case earlier this year in which a client, an investor, sued UBS and an advisor who was part of UBS because that advisor had... I don't know if it had an affair. I'd need to read the story properly, but effectively his wife had ended up with that financial advisor, and he now felt that they had taken actions which were to their benefit and not to his. And I suppose there's just the danger isn't there.
Around. Right. It certainly seems kind of prudent to keep some form of distance from your advisor or broker.
Yeah, interesting. Well, look, we'll keep an eye on that case, and as we say, we do wait to see what the other side says formally, because it is, you know, only fair to do so. Brilliant. Well, look, fascinating story. Thank you, Alec and Ian. We couldn't go, of course, without talking about a deal. This is RIA land after all, and despite question marks over, exits for PE deals, for despite question marks over where rates are, despite question marks over lots of things, PE continues to pour money into the RIA space and deals continue to be done. But the most interesting one this week has got nothing to do with PE.
Yes, that's exactly correct. So we broke earlier this week on Tuesday that Sammons Financial Group, which is a large insurance and annuities holding company, that they agreed to buy Wealthcare Capital Management, which is an $8 billion hybrid RIA based out of Pennsylvania near Philadelphia. And we broke that Wealthcare is pursuing a new investor back in December of 2024. What I think is interesting here is that Wealthcare was a PE-backed firm. They're backed by New Spring Capital. And instead of going to another sponsor, they went to a firm in Sammons that is probably going to hold this company for a very long time. I mean, they were talking about decades in terms of a hold period. And that's a lot different than the typical 4 to 7 year PE hold period that we discuss.
Okay, so I want to get into a little bit about that and about sort of this idea of kind of permanent capital and what that might mean. Before we do, very quickly, for those who aren't familiar with Wealthcare, can you give us the sort of the skinny on the size and shape of that firm?
Great. So Wealthcare, based in Westchester, PA, they were actually founded in around 1999 by a gentleman by the name of David Loper, who was actually a software developer who developed his own suite of financial planning software, now known as GDX 360. There was actually issues in which he had litigation against UBS over some issues around his software and patents around that, I believe. He retired in 2013 when New Spring acquired the company, which has now evolved into two main business models. So there's the W-2 employee advisor channel, which is your traditional, you work for us, you do business under our brand name, and you're a full-time employee. And then they have a lot of Form 1099 contractor advisors, and a lot of those are also affiliated with LPL, which is a frequent guest, frequent subject on this podcast, I may add.
Yeah, what would you call LPL? Yeah, just a presence somehow on the pod. Okay, and the firm, you may have mentioned this already, the firm is how big?
$8 billion in assets.
$8 billion, okay. And was owned by a PE backer, which sort of along the normal timelines of PE backers decided to sell. Okay, so talk to us a little bit about why Sammons as an insurance company is an interesting buyer and what that might mean for WealthCare.
I think one, Sammons is a pretty closely held employee-owned company. They're on the Forbes top 100 list for the largest private companies in the U.S. So it's a firm that's not necessarily looking to flip, not looking to monetize these firms quickly. I think Sammons, it makes sense rationally as an insurance firm, annuity shop, that you can view some of these RIAs as distribution channels for your insurance products, which, you know, neither good nor bad. That's just a thing.
And well, Sammons, I have an opinion, but anyway.
And it's also worth noting that Sammons actually already owns an investment outsourcing business called Beacon Capital Management. And they also own a large RIA based in Minneapolis called Northrock Partners. And so when I spoke to officials from Sammons and WealthCare, the Sammons representative, Michael Mock, who helps run wealth management strategy there, he said there are probably going to be some sort of back office synergies between the three wealth management entities, even if they're going to keep operating independently and keep their brand identities.
Got it. Yeah. So it's not a kind of big aggregation play, smash them together, get them onto one platform, rebrand. But there might be, there's obviously some benefits that could be had. Some
exactly.
Sort of cost savings or shared best practices, et cetera. Okay, brilliant. And in terms of Sammons, yeah, they're just not looking to sell. They, you know, obviously, as discussed before, there are lots of things that are very attractive about owning an RIA business.
I wish I owned one. The cash flows are great.
Well, I feel like you're almost M&A. You're so M&A adjacent, Ian. Maybe you could get into that space. So, you know,
I do have a friend who runs his own private equity firm.
Well, you heard it here first. Bye, Ian. Next time we see you, you pick us up in your sports car and show us the RIAs you've acquired. You probably have an eye for it. I mean, I'm not joking. You probably do know some firms that, you know, no one has picked up on yet.
Well, I would say to any PE sponsor, don't stress. His main investment thesis he wanted to work on with me was investing in car washes.
Fair enough. Well, look, thank you both very much. Indeed, I think we've covered an awful lot of ground there. Another very busy week. In sort of RIA land. So we'll leave it there. But Alec, thanks so much for joining us and regaling us with that story. Before we go, I suppose, have you rewatched Captain Phillips recently?
I have not, but you know, I'm glad that we were able to kind of fit in references to a movie that came out more than a decade ago. You know, not a sponsor, obviously, but you know, it's a good watch. So.
Not a sponsor, yeah. Any film recommendations before we do go from either of you?
Go see Sinners.
Go see Sinners.
Go see Sinners. I also saw Friendship. If you're a Tim Robinson fan, it's a really fun time.
It looks painful. It looks. I mean, I like everyone in it, but could it be a hard watch?
If you're not into awkward comedy, then yes, it probably will be a difficult watch.
Okay. Well, look, on that recommendation, we'll call it quits. Thank you both very much indeed, and thank you, listener. And we'll be back again very soon for another week in wealth. Goodbye.